like to convene the Joint Finance and Ways and Means Committee, and we'll just have the staff, as is the tradition, take the role for the two committees, because separate sets of minutes will be developed. We're going to have a presentation this evening then on Governor Pawlenty's budget recommendations. As all of us know, they just came out yesterday, and so this will be the first hearing, and the idea is that this is going to be an introduction to the budget, and most of the work in the end, of course, will be done in the various divisions of the Finance Committee, and the targets and so on being worked on with the Ways and Means Committee. So this is kind of step one after we've received the budget, and I'm not sure who's going to go first. Will that be you, Commissioner Hanson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, welcome to the committee, and why don't you begin to walk us through.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There may be some questions to come up as we go, because I think
that would be one
way we'd like to proceed rather than waiting until the end.
Okay. I think that was excellent. Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Tom Hanson. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget. Sitting to my left is our State Budget Director, Jim Showalter, and we are here to present the Governor's budget recommendations and begin the process of working with you and to come up with what will be our final budget sometime, hopefully, in mid-May. If I could put direct your attention, you think you all have the slides in your packet?
Yes.
And it's also on the screen. The first slide is up there to remind us all of better times back about almost 2 years ago when we finished the 2008-09 biennial budget. We had $34.6 billion. Our economy was growing at a whopping...
Could I maybe just make a quick comment to members? We are being taped. It's not being broadcast, but it will be broadcast later, so it's important that you keep that in mind as you're visiting with one another. And the other thing is cell phones probably should be turned off. They do impact when we're being broadcast. They don't know if they impact when we're being taped, and the chair will turn his off right now.
Okay,
Mr. I just wanted
you
to make that announcement. I should have done it earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was saying, just trying to remind us all of fonder times, and the number that strikes me on this sheet is $161 billion deficit and 1.2 of the gross domestic product. That doesn't mean much to me until I saw the next slide. The next slide, the situation as it is today, instead of 34.6, we have 31.9 from biennium over biennium. That's quite a remarkable change due to the current economic conditions that we're facing, as well as other states and, frankly, other countries around the world. The economy is expected to shrink by 2.5%. That's quite a swing from the 2.1 we predicted when we initially passed the 2008-2009 budget. And probably the saddest number of the two charts is the number of Minnesotans working. That's a 51,000 person drop, and I'm guessing that as we go forward with the job numbers, that'll go down even more. And then finally, the difference, almost tenfold difference in the federal budget deficit, $1.2 trillion and 8.3% of the gross domestic product. That is the context for which the governor prepared his budget, and we're submitting to you for your consideration. The next slide outlines the governor's budget priorities. First and foremost, we want to balance the budget, and we presented to you a balanced budget. Number two, as the governor has said, we are funding priorities in order of importance. Third, we have to do more than just balancing the budget. We have to strategically position Minnesota for success in an ever-changing world. Fourth, the governor wants to enhance and expand pay for performance. And fifth, the governor's budget doesn't increase burdens by raising taxes. As we put this budget together, we kept these important financial management goals in place. Despite the challenge before us, we felt it was necessary to reestablish our budget reserve, which was utilized, which was drained in December with the when the December 4th forecast showed the state in deficit. So we established a $250 million budget reserve to address additional economic risk. Mr. Chairman, I want to remind you and the members of the committee that we still have in statute a the next time there is a surplus, when that comes, and I presume one day it will happen, the we are required with the surplus first to pay off the $653 million of the budget reserve and then pay off the school shift, which you will see from us in a few minutes. We use the K-12 shift similar to what occurred in the early part of this decade to the 80-20. So that's about a $1.3 billion. So as far as financial management and the paying those off, that statute was in place from a few years ago. We also retained the $350 million cash flow, which we're fortunate to have and which we all deserve credit for throughout tough times. It was a bipartisan with the legislature and the Senate, the House, and the governor to retain a cash flow, and it helped us this fall when other states like California and Connecticut and others were scrounging around worrying about whether they were going to be able to borrow in the short-term bond market. We had cash flow and didn't have to worry about it at all. And then finally, the next item, we understate the potential level of the federal fiscal assistance, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And then we improve our structural budget by, we cut the deficit in the out biennium by nearly half. So the bottom line, and the budget bottom line you see here, it's a $34.36 billion from 8 and 9, and when you track it biennium over biennium, kind of apples to apples, it's a $33.61 billion budget we're submitting to you. That's a difference of a minus 2.2% drop overall, or $750 million. The next four slides, Mr. Chairman and members, outlines overall the big major pieces of the governor's budget. This slide outlines the major categories, the spending, the other resources, and that tax cut slide, and then each slide after that drills down more on those topics. So you see on the direct you to the slide in front of you, it was a $4.847 billion deficit, and we have summarized it for you in three categories. The first one, spending cuts and savings, is a $2.521 billion. And you'll see in a moment what each of those means and what the amount is. And then the second category, other resources, $3.197. And then finally, the tax cuts, initiatives, and reserves at at a cost of $860 million. Leaves us with a bottom line of $11 million.
Representative Huntley had a question. Representative Huntley.
Commissioner Hansen, on the previous slide, you said there was a 2.2% cut. What was the percentage if it was based on what we had previously forecast?
It's a great question, and it's further down in the slides.
Okay. Now, why don't you continue and then just be sure you highlight that for Representative Huntley,
sure,
and other committee members.
Yeah, and actually, just to Representative Huntley's question, it is a difficult story as you start talking about it and discussing it in committees, the facets of this budget with some of the items we have. When you can compare it to the previous biennium, actual spending, but then you also have as Representative Huntley is alluding to, there's the forecasted base that we projected in the December 4th, and you'll see in a slide we have later on how the numbers in each of the, particularly in the area that Representative Huntley's involved in, the differences based on your comparisons. So we want to make sure that we present all of that to you. But back to the slides, the slide in front of you is the summary. And now we're going to go to the spending cuts and savings slide. The $2.521 million on this slide represents 2.368 in permanent spending cuts, and then the governor's recommendations merges the health care access fund with the general fund, and because the health care access fund had a surplus, we pick up another 150 so, and then there's some other dollar amounts in there. In a later slide, we will lay out, Mr. Chairman, as you had recommended, detailing the cuts in more detail. Our other resources, three categories, which we will talk about in detail a little later as well. The federal stimulus placeholder, $920 million. Factoring the progress in Washington, we figured it was more accurate to project some type of reception of federal money. We picked this amount, and again, I'll get into that in a minute. The K-12 shift represents, right now, it's a 90-20. We pay 90% of payments to school districts in the current biennium, and we settle up with them the 10% in the next biennium. We changed that ratio to 80-20. We did something similar in 2001 and 2002, earlier in this biennium. It gives us 1.294. It also includes the property tax recognition shift, and we also include the same language, Mr. Chairman and members, that we did the last time for schools and statutory operating debt. And then the tobacco appropriation bonds, the net on that is $983 million, and we will talk about that here in a minute as well.
Representative Silver.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, in the language you use, the tobacco appropriation bonds, and you've said in other meetings that they're really not related to the tobacco at all, they're more just appropriation bonds. I don't know if that was your language that said that, or if it was Mr. Showalter's language. My question is that the securitization of the tobacco monies in other states have proved to be very costly to the states, and that's almost not marketable in some respects. My question is, on this appropriation bond, which is more of it's an appropriation instead of a not related to the tobacco, but to the general fund. When you keep using tobacco appropriation bonds, are you going to have a little bit more difficulty in either marketing these or putting the perception out that these are related to the tobacco, and they may be some of the securitization of the tobacco funds, and thus become a little bit less marketable or not rated as high?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to have our Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management, Kathy Cardell, helped me with that.
I just wanted to be very specific on the terminology, because I know there will be another meeting with Representative Hausmann for more details.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Kathy Cardell. I'm apologizing for my voice in advance. It's a little bit hoarse today. I'm the Assistant Commissioner and Treasury for Minnesota Management and Budget. And if I understood Representative, I think it was Silver's question correctly, for purposes of making sure that the membership understands what the intended source of repayment for these bonds are, I believe, I didn't write this, but I believe that that's why they utilize the term tobacco appropriation bonds. But in any authorizing legislation, I would recommend that we not attach any sort of tobacco pledge to that, because it does, as you accurately pointed out, those bonds, there's no market for a tobacco securitization issue any longer, at least not in the foreseeable future. And so this is truly an appropriation credit of the state.
I guess, Mr. Chair, my concern is the terminology that's being used. When we say it's a tobacco appropriation bond, and it's not related at all to that, nor should it be related to that,
will cause some difficulties in respect in the public eye. So maybe we should use the correct terminology on this stuff. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Commissioner Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hundley.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question to Commissioner Hanson?
Mr. Hanson.
If we want to call it what it is this borrowing money for current expenses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hundley, I don't think so. I think it is we have a stream of revenue that in a critical time in our state in which we have our major employers, we saw Target, Best Buy laying off thousands of employees, we are utilizing a tool that cushions the impact of our economy. The harm we would do with that extra $1 billion, either if you raise taxes or cut spending more, is prohibitive in these times.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, if I could sort of add on, I don't think we need a qualifier. It's absolutely not being used for operating expenses. Federal tax law would prohibit the use of these proceeds. We will make sure that those funds are segregated and used for things that are quite clearly non-operating funds. The debt service, the capital projects are quite clearly non-operating costs based upon the advice of the bond council. We cannot use it for operating costs.
Well, they didn't answer the question. They are borrowing money from this and going to pay it back over the future to pay things that we normally pay for during this biennium. So they're doing exactly what the Republicans have done in Washington, which is borrow and spend.
Commissioner Hanson, did you want to continue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The next slide is the tax cuts initiatives and reserves slide. You will see the governor's new spending initiative, the $323 million, primarily in the K-12 education area. Our tax cuts and tax savings net out to $287 million, and the budget reserve again at $250 million. So what were the governor's key priorities? One is to enhance Minnesota's job climate. As I said earlier in my remarks, we're increasingly worried that about what's happening in the job market in our state. Improve K-12 education, protect the state's public safety program, maintain military and veteran affairs, and increase government reform and accountability. First area I would like to talk about more specifically is what we call the Minnesota Jobs Recovery Act. It's the job creation is the priority, and it's the governor's tax reductions. The first thing on the list is reducing the corporate rate from 9.8% to 4.8%. That occurs over a period of 6 years. It goes in tax 10, it goes to 8.8, Mr. Chairman, goes to 7.8 and 11, goes down a half a point in 12 to 7.3, it goes down to 6.8 and 13, 5.8 and 14, and it hits the 4.8 mark in 2015. So it is phased in over a period of years.
Okay, Commissioner, we have a question that just came up recently.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, we've had a series of hearings in the House talking with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and thus far they haven't really been able to give a very clear picture as to why Minnesota's economy is underperforming the rest of the nation. And the state economist hasn't been able to give a very clear, even strong hypothesis as to why that's happening. And I guess what I'm wondering about is what is the economic analysis, or how do you come to the decision that this program of business tax cuts and other tax credits and so on is going to actually have some measurable effect on Minnesota's economy? What's the analysis that underlies that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, the fundamental philosophy or analysis is that we believe that businesses, given the ability to invest, would turn around and make investments that create jobs, that we are a high tax state, and that given the ability to lower the actual cost of doing business. Businesses will turn around and will be make it and be more competitive with their counterparts. In a world that's with the technology that you're so familiar with, it makes the world a much smaller place, and jobs can flow to a much cheaper environment with the touch of the button on the computer. So,
Mr. Chair, I guess my only comment would be that if the Department of Economic Development can give a clear picture and the state economists can give a clear picture as to what the needs are, it seems to me that an investment of this size based on a philosophy is not something that we can afford either.
Rep. Simbun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up on what Mr. Representative Wickler just said, in giving your answer, Commissioner, you just indicated, you phrased it, you said philosophy or analysis, and then you used the phrase, quote, we believe, end quote. I think what we were asking specifically about is what kind of really concrete economic analysis or modeling would go into such a proposal. I would hope that given these kinds of times and the amounts of dollars involved in this type of a program, that we are not basing it on belief but on evidence based on sound research. And as Representative Wickler even said, I don't think we've heard any evidence of the sound analysis and research that's gone into this. Not that maybe it is not sound, but we need to be based on evidence in making these tough decisions. Any further comments?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, I can imagine Dr. Stinson saying something similar as a fellow economist to yourself. The governor's, what I meant to, what I maybe inarticulately tried to say is the governor's philosophy of government is that the more, you start out at the basic philosophical level, the more costs you put in doing business in a specific state, the more likely at this time in this job environment the jobs are going to go elsewhere. If it's cheaper to operate in South Carolina or India, your board of directors and your CEOs and your people making critical capital decisions have fiduciary responsibilities, and they're going to flow the capital to the places that it's cheaper. It is our belief, and I didn't bring the job charts, but is we have data that shows that our tax rates in this state directly correlate with that. Say that a different way: the states that have a lower business tax rate, job growth is growing, and that is the basis for our decisions in this area.
There's the money set. There's the money.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quick follow up. I actually favor some of these reductions in business taxes, but the key question is, if that's all that mattered, our key businesses would be located in Wyoming today. So it's much more complicated than that. Therefore, the question is, when we're lowering various taxes, particularly in a time of deficit, we need to have some sense of really how much bang for our buck we're going to get for that in terms of future prosperity and job creation, because there's some serious trade-offs in terms of loss of health care and other kinds of things in education. So I think that it suggests to me that maybe we need to enhance our economic modeling capacity in our state to make better decisions.
And one more thing, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, you could probably educate me on the corporate tax is probably, from a volatility standpoint, the worst source of revenue we have, and is one of the reasons why we see the variability in our state revenue.
Representative Hilton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what conditions that the governor's put in his budget? As we saw with the federal economic stimulus package, we were supposed to give money to businesses, and that was supposed to trickle out to the rest of the economy, and as we've seen, that has not happened with the first round of the economic stimulus package. So what do you have in the governor's budget to make certain that if businesses get these reductions, that they actually don't just put it on their bottom line or, profit their stockholders rather than actually investing in Minnesota?
Before you answer, just a quick point. We got a note that the audio in the audience is bad, and the request from somewhere in the audience is if members, and I'll assume our testifiers as well, be sure you speak into the mic so that
like this,
people can hear. That wasn't directed at Representative Hilstrom, just overall. Commissioner Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hilstrom, I think you're You were referring to the fact that at the federal level, and I think I heard in the paper that the Treasury Department stopped some corporation from buying a jet. And the first part of your question was referring to the first bit of money that went out. In our budget right now, we have a $920 million placeholder that does not factor in any of the interactions. So we don't know what they will be. Our supplemental budget will have that piece. The on the governor's tax credits, these are tax credits based on, and I'm starting to get far afield of my area of expertise, but they are based on their the activity that the corporation is. Maybe he'll be on.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe I think where the trouble is going is on the types of tax credits that the governor is proposing. I believe all of them, but certainly most of them, are effective after the investment's been made. So it's not a upfront cash check kind of thing like the first portion of the federal stimulus bill earlier this year. This is actually after the after the capital equipment has been bought, after the equipment purchases have been made. So those are activities that would already have happened in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I do see reduce Minnesota's high business tax rate as the number one bullet. So I would assume that the business tax rate would be reduced whether or not you make an investment. Is that correct?
Mr. Walder. Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that would be correct. On the straight corporate income tax rate, I stand corrected because that would not necessarily result in any change in business activity in Minnesota. It would be a simple change in rate with the expectation that it might make it more attractive to work in Minnesota. I think the other ones that I was looking at are really related to activities that would have to be taken in Minnesota. But you're right.
Representative Hillstrom is at. Okay, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, your comment about South Carolina and India was interesting. Is your proposal to get the cost of doing business in Minnesota equivalent to that in India?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, it was the first place that came into my mind. I don't know if they're really had, I just threw it out.
Okay, that's it for the question, temporarily at least. Commissioner Hanson, you want to continue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The rest of this, some of the other points on this slide. The upfront capital equipment sales exemption gives an upfront exemption. The one-year deduction for the equipment purchases is a 25% refundable tax credit designated for small businesses in the current tax year 2009. The angel and early stage capital tax credits is over the cost kicks in 2012 and 13 at a $12.5 million cost, and it's designed to stimulate the investment, especially half of the money is supposed to go for green jobs. And then finally, the 50% capital gains exemption. The next area I'd like to talk about is the K-12 education. The governor is increasing K-12 education even in a budget crisis. We're transforming K-12 education, the funding system, by linking all future increases to improve performance, and we're requiring all districts and charter schools to use QComp, the QComp performance pay system. Currently, 44 schools.
Representative Brown wanted to. Representative Grounding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hanson. The theme that we keep hearing over and over again, and we heard it at the Humphrey Institute also from our state demographer and our state economist, is that we need to make sure, because of all the retirements and, you know, the peak year being 2010, that we have all students, whether they are at the lower end of the opportunity gap and whether they don't speak English, whether they are poor or whatever, we need to make sure that they're all being productive. And I'm noticing that
You're saying all future increases are linked to performance, and we had a hearing on this in Education Finance yesterday. And we understand that this would be funding for students who are doing well on the test, and it would be prorated for each district based on how many of those students that they have. But I'm wondering how the funding for the students who aren't doing well, you might want to incent districts to have them do well, but what if they didn't get early childhood and they didn't get help with their various needs and they didn't do well on the tests, and then now they're getting less funding? And then my second question, Mr. Chair, is on about the pay for the QCOMP. And here it says, and I've heard the governor say, that it's for all districts must participate, and hence they all get a 5% increase, and QCOMP is now $300 per pupil instead of $260 per pupil. But when we actually had the hearing yesterday and we talked to Commissioner Shegren, members, we found out that it wasn't for all students in all districts. It was all districts must put forward a plan, try to work on it. But if it didn't get approved, if they're in a district where the teachers union didn't approve it and so forth, then there would be many ways, and in fact the budget showed that it did not expect anywhere near all districts to get this money, then all students wouldn't have those opportunities. And I'm just wondering about the haves and have-nots in this budget for education, and how it's going to improve our economy if it's not working with all kids. We have to have all kids graduating ready for success, and that's our biggest commodity, according to the economists here in Minnesota. So I'm wondering, how does this address the opportunity gap?
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greiling, the governor's proposal is designed to incent school districts, I guess it's the first part of your question, if they want the additional money, then to increase performance to bring their student up to that level. That's, you know, in this specific proposal we're offering, it's designed to give them a carrot in front of them so they work to educate the students. If they don't, then in this proposal they want to get the, you know, the 1% for the medium or moderate level and the 2% for the high performing students. And as far as QCOMP, the governor's whole proposal is designed to try to bring more creative and try to bring some more bang for the buck in education.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, if I could just add on the latter point. For QCOMP, as you know, those agreements are reached through labor agreements, both between the school district and the unions, and also funded by the state. And so the assumption is that model would continue, that this wouldn't be usurping local control and forcing that on. You're right that the budget page doesn't assume that everyone will automatically turn on from day one. That's going to take some time, as it has for the first few years.
Representative Rowling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I did not hear my question answered about the opportunity gap. And members, when we get to the next slide, we'll see that 44 districts and 26 charter schools are currently in QCOMP. Those districts are disproportionately metro, disproportionately suburban, and now all those districts will go from $260 per pupil to $300 per pupil, but those that aren't in the budget to even be getting into QCOMP won't get any of that $300 per pupil or even $260 per pupil. And so I just did not get an answer about the opportunity gap. It seems to me that when some have QCOMP and some do not, and we're not necessarily going to be hitting the areas where some of the students aren't doing well in large numbers with the opportunity gap, and then when we have this pay for performance, which we had people from the university tell us actually results in inequities. We didn't think we needed the university to tell us that, but they did based on research. So I'd still like an answer to my question. How does this funding address the opportunity gap?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greiling, we also have a proposal in the governor's budget called Summer of Success, which is a proposal designed to intervene with students. There is the Principals Leadership Institute and the virtual education program designed to improve students' performance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I'd just like, for those who aren't on the K-12 committee, and I know there are many here that are, like Representative Garofalo. So he knows, like I know, and like Representative Tilbury knows, and Representative Swales know, and others that are on K-12 finance, that back when we had the last big cuts in education, the extended time revenue was cut by $25 million. And that was money for all struggling students. Now we have three pilots for some eighth graders around the state. But what about the rest of the eighth graders, not to mention the kindergartners through 12th graders who are struggling, and they won't have summer school, after school, extended time? You know, this is putting a couple of tidbits back for what the governor cut last time. And I just don't like it that he gets good publicity for three pilots for something that used to be for all struggling students. We should be sort of glad, I guess, for a couple of crumbs being put back in. But, you know, the opportunity gap would help a lot more if all struggling students were able to have extra time like these few eighth graders were going to get. So it's better than nothing, but it sure ain't as good as we had in 2003.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greiling, we did not, in this proposal, we do not cut K-12 education. I don't know what last time are you referring to.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm referring to the last time we had cuts in education, which were the also under Governor Pawlenty, and that was those cuts have not been made up, $25 million, and that was for extended time revenue, which is for struggling students that need a summer of success, or whatever we're calling this, these three pilots for a few eighth graders.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greiling, I remember back to 2003, it was not classroom type. I think it wasn't cuts to the classroom. You're referring to after school program, so it was not, is that correct?
Well, throwing me these bones, Mr. Hansen.
I'm not the education commissioner.
That was not the classroom. He made cuts, however, to the classroom in addition to that, and some of those have still not been made up either. One of them, well, the biggest one of all, was special education. He cut and capped and prorated special education, and that is the reason that most districts now go out to raise property taxes through their referendums. If that cut hadn't been made, which we haven't managed to fix either, we put a lot of money in last year, but we're kind of back to the same problem we started with because it's such a fast growing area of the budget. And, you know, some of the things that would actually help with that area of the budget are in the Health and Human Services Committee. So with those huge cuts in the Health and Human Services Committee, we're going to do nothing but see more special education costs, which are health care costs and are the fastest growing area of K-12. And that does, Commissioner Hansen, directly affect the classroom. It did when those cuts were made in 2003. It did in 2004, 2005, 6, 7, 8, and it is today because there is nothing in this budget to address special education.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'll just quit while I'm behind.
The one thing I was going to do is compliment the committee. You know, virtually, in fact, I think all the division chairs except one serve on this committee, and they do know their subject area. So I identify with you on that side of the table.
As I have found out over the last few years.
We have a question from Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, what's that?
To talk into it.
I got a loud voice. What about this? No? All right. So, first of all, Commissioner, my apologies to you. I think we probably could have saved everyone a lot of time tonight if we just got a running tape here and just had it say, Pawlenty sucks, Pawlenty sucks. That probably would have summarized the message you're going to get tonight.
Senator Oppolo, there hasn't been any comments like that. There have been maybe some questions that you would have preferred not to be asked, but I think your comments are out of order in terms of the decorum of this committee, and I would appreciate it if you'd ask your question and engage in less political rhetoric.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I must just be upset because I'm missing the Rochester party tonight. That might have something to do with it. Commissioner, I appreciate the newfound concern and newfound fondness we have for equity and fairness in the education funding formula. As you remember, last session we passed a K-12 bill that I would call mediocre K-12 bill that increased the disparity in funding between our urban school districts and suburban and rural ones. In my district, we saw school districts and cities of the first class get anywhere from a 60 to 150% bigger increase than our schools. I'm wondering, in formulating this budget, that disparity in funding, did that improve the achievement gap at all? Did it give us better outcomes in the cities of the first class? Do you have any evidence to back that up?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Apple.
Thank you. In the formulation of this, you're talking about the success, I think it was the Successful Schools Initiative, where we have this growth model. Now, my understanding is that this is not a matter of just saying that the schools that got good kids or kids that come from good socioeconomic backgrounds that continue to do good get rewarded with extra money, but actually there's sort of a growth model, so that if you have a kid that starts out behind but makes progress towards achievement, maybe not at proficiency or above proficiency, but it's making improvement, but you can actually qualify for these gains. Is that true? And maybe you or the addition, Mr. Showalter could talk about that a little bit.
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what the second of the proposals here is looking at is referring to linking the funding increases to improved performance, and it's at a student-based level. So, as the representative alludes, if a student is making adequate progress between those 2 years that this person is tested, a certain amount of increase will be available to that school district. If they make greater than normal advances, then an additional funding would be available. If they are not able to make grade level advancement, then that school district wouldn't get additional funding. I think the incentive structure is there to look at an individual student to take them wherever they're at and continue to move them forward, hopefully at an accelerated rate.
Representative Bernard.
Mr. Chair, not to derail the whole discussion, but I've been intimately involved in the growth model formulation, and I would say that Representative Garofalo is correct in that students from schools who may have a large number of students who are not at proficiency but still growing are able to achieve this monetary reward, but many would argue that it's premature to attach a monetary value to these numbers when we've just put the growth model out and schools are just beginning to identify what it says about their performance, and the real goal is to identify best practice and move it into the schools that are performing at lower level rather than kind of a carrot and stick approach.
Okay, Commissioner? You were on the transforming K-12 for 1 minute.
We'll go for paper progress. I think we've talked about, for the most part, the education slides. This just talks about what representative the program that Representative Greiling was commenting on and others, the new pay for performance initiative, and then the talks about how it's funded on the bullet point below that. I think we can, but if there's any more education questions, we can move on to the pie chart.
I don't see any hands up, so why don't you call?
Oh, I see one over here.
Yeah, that's in the hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little about education, but my school districts are QCOMP districts, so they have bought into the QCOMP. So my question is, did the governor put pay for performance in his budget for his department heads? Because, for example, the department that is within my committee's jurisdiction did not meet all of their targets for this past budget cycle. And so did the governor take this QCOMP proposal and pay for performance one step further to his own staff?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilster, my pay for performance is I do my job, I do it well, or I'm fired. That's, you know, the governor, that's mine. But no, we don't have a comparable Q comp for commissioners. Our funding is capped at $108,000 or something like that.
Mr. Chair.
Thanks,
Mr. Chair. I just think that, again, my school districts do this pay for performance, and if it is good for our schools to get compliance, it certainly should be good for the governor's department heads in getting compliance and getting the best out of our government.
Let's go. Continue on.
All right, I don't need to spend a lot of time on the pie charts on this one. I just wanted to remind everybody that 90% of our budget is education, health care, and local government aids, and that any budget you put together, those the dollar amounts in those are intricately linked. And not to say that the rest of the smaller slivers are not important, but the 90% drives any budget. And then, Mr. Chairman, on the next slide, reminding everybody we have a number of different funds, and overall it's $57 million, $57 billion. Now getting back to a couple of slides, back to addressing Representative Huntley's question early, the look that you have in front of you compares the actual dollars spent in 8-9, not the forecast, not the forecasted base that we forecasted and in the December forecast, but it's 8-9 compared to funding in 10 and 11. And you see in this chart we add money to K-12 education, and you see that Health and Human Services on this chart appears and it actually increases funding by 9.6%. But you'll see, as I'm sure Representative Huntley knows, that when we look at the next slide, the base, the forecasted base, we can just jump ahead real quick to that. I mean, it changes. We forecast, the forecasted growth in human services is supposed to be 12.627. It is. We factor in growth for medical inflation, and all of a sudden the number is actually a decrease. It was going to be in excess of 20%, but we reduce it back to 9 point. You can go back to the other slide.
Representative Huntley. Mr. Chair, if you could go back to the previous slide, I had a question. I'm pretty slow on this stuff, but I think I'm starting to understand my question earlier about the tobacco money, which is the tobacco money. But the debt service, you say, is not a general operating expense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, it is it's a defined term, and no, it is not.
So what we're really doing is we're going to borrow money to pay the interest that we're already supposed to be paying out of another fund. So in effect, what we're doing is using our Visa card to make the payments on our American Express card.
Also, in the proposal, it's borrowing a little bit more on the Visa card to pay the interest on the Visa card, too, before you get to the American Express. But Ms. Showalter, you used a term that was kind of interesting to me. You said it's a defined term. There's lots of defined terms in the budget.
Mr. Chair, I don't...
I think you use the term, it's a defined term or something. I think it's what the verbiage you used. I know it's a category, but the agriculture is a defined term in the budget, too. So we can't borrow, it's a short term for that. And I don't want to belabor the point, but I do want to go down the road of where Representative Huntley is, and you can see that on this, it's a general fund obligation. It's been a general fund obligation in the past, and we've had all kinds of argument of how big that obligation should be, as you know, the debate over the 3% and so forth. But it is a shift, and it is a borrowing for paying off a fund.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Assistant Commissioner Kathy Cardell can clarify more when we get to the tobacco appropriation bonds later in the presentation. But I just want to clear.
He doesn't want you to use the word tobacco even.
Exactly. To be clear, I for the record, this is an official hearing, and I want to be clear that the purpose is not for operating funds, because the documents, the purpose of these bonds is explicitly for non-operating.
I understand that. Okay. There will be extensive hearings in Representative Housen's committee, I think, next Tuesday on this very issue. So continue on, and Commissioner.
That's fine. Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, you had both asked for us to include a slide to summarize our kind of the big reduction areas, and that is before you. County aids is a $126 million reduction in 10 and 11. Local government aids, $246. The University of Minnesota, $151. And Minsky at $146.
Commissioner, does the $246 in the local government aids include the market value credit? Or is that in addition?
It does not.
And the market value credit cut is, was that $77 million? Is that correct? To those cities that get market value credit and not local government aid?
Mr. Chair, that looks about right. The state funding for the market value credit was $418 million, which reduced to $349
million. So, 73, my sister, I was close. Okay, continue on.
I'm on the next.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, I guess I'm looking here at the little footnote here, and I'm glad that I got my eyes checked, because I could, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to read that before. But
I had trouble reading it, too.
But it says here, and I just do I catch this right? It says additional market value credit reductions will be taken away from cities that do not receive LGA. So currently my city does not receive, so they're going to get nicked even more on their market value credit. Is that what I'm reading here?
No, Representative.
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, to make it even and fair amongst all cities, if your city doesn't get LGA, they will get a comparable reduction in their market value credit.
But it's not...
Mr.
Representative Nelson, number was not on the list of reductions for to local units of government, and I was... That's why I question them. The number that they should not have a little star with small print, but have actually said that there's a reduction in market credit stage of $73 million.
Had we put it on there, would have even been smaller print.
Representative Huntley, did you have another question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just had a comment. In an earlier slide, the governor's, one of his top budget priorities was to protect state public safety programs, and he did say state. But if you look at the local government aid cuts to the city of Duluth, or most other cities are exactly the same, about half our budget is police and fire. So when you cut city budgets, you're cutting cops and firefighters. And that certainly has an impact on public safety.
Representative Knuth, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and... Commissioner Hanson, Mr. Showalter, I'm looking at these higher education cuts and trying to figure out a way to really get a sense of what they actually mean to the young people in Minnesota, our future workforce, and the quality of programming we have. And I don't know the number offhand of how many students we have in our higher education system, but do you do a per student calculation on that? I'm curious if how much of a per-student reduction that would be, or if you could get us those numbers.
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we can certainly get you that information.
Okay. If you would give it to the fiscal staff, that would be great, sir. Representative Rukavina, before you start, I get to the table and take a... microphone.
Oh, I was going to come up and do the Garofalo chant, but the reason I came forward.
Well, Representative Rukavina, you would also get
No, but I'm curious, Mr. Hansen, as to where you come up with the 8.2% change in higher education when my staff and fiscal analysts are telling me it's 11%.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina here, I thought I lucked out when I didn't see you at the table.
Commissioner, was that a question?
It's a question. Yeah. I Mr. Showalter, maybe, because my staff, yes, one of my business analysts, and I think he's nodding that I'm correct, and I know people have been talking 10% and using figures of 8%, and I'm just wondering, you know, is this more Enron accounting practices, or...
Good evening. Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Rolowska. I'm an executive budget coordinator at MMB. Overall, higher education has received a 10% cut. The systems themselves have taken a little bit more than a 10% cut because the governor in his budget proposal protected the student grant program a little bit. So it's overall 10% for higher education, but slightly more than that for both of the systems. And I think the university is like 10.8 and Minsky is 10.7, something like that.
So then why do you say 8.2?
Where's he reading that?
I mean, that's a hell of a big difference.
I don't know where you're...
Well, on the slide here, and it's slide number, whatever it is, it says right there, and that's the numbers that I'm being...
Oh. Yeah, it's... Mike? Commissioner, I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And Representative Rukavina. What we would be talking about there would be the slide just previous to this one that you're looking at. That 10% would be the comparison of the budget proposal to the forecast. That was the 10%, the 9.9. Compared to 2008-2009 spending, that's where you get the 8.2% adjustment.
Representative Rukavina?
Well, no, I'm Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted people to be aware that, you know, it's misleading, and I just wanted everyone in the room to know, because I'm hearing people say, well, we could have been cut worse and we were cut proportionally, and that's not the case. It isn't the case. And, Mr. Chair, well, I do have the floor for you, if I could, just to Mr. Hansen. Given the fact that in these types of economic conditions, Mr. Hansen, people go back to school and there's a lot of pressure put on the higher education system, do you think it's wise to even have a 10.8 or 10.9 cut to the university and the Minsky system? And you can have a fictitious or proposal, and you know the governor can direct the Board of Trustees at Minsky to not raise tuition, but he really can't direct the Board of Regents. And if you don't raise tuition, you lay off, the only other place to do it is staff. So where are the teachers and the professors going to be to train the folks to have a business climate, or to train the folks that lost their job that need to learn a new trade or a new profession, when the only place then that the Minsky system and the university can cut is professors, teachers, staff?
Do one of you want to respond to that question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, if I could, Mr. Chair, to your first comment about misleading, you know, when I started my presentation, I said it's a complex story, and then we have two different slides where we detail and outline that and explicitly say there, due to the some of the variables in the budget, that it is a difficult story to describe. It's misleading if I don't have the charts that I'm trying to look at our representative content.
Boy, that's hard when I can't, nobody can see me over representative.
No, I'm off my train of thought. But I think it's misleading if we don't lay it out this way. As far as your general comment about whether we should have reductions in K-12 education, or higher education,
We, in the governor's budget, we won't set a specific number on the tuition, on whether tuition can be increased. We want to work with you on that. But they still have some flexibility within that, whatever we agree with you on. But with a $4.8 billion deficit, you have to make some difficult decisions. And we felt with whatever room they have in their tuition cap that we work with you on that, they'll be able to manage these reductions.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that final point, and I'll shut up, Commissioner Hansen, you're a good man doing your job. But I don't think there's a person sitting around this table, if there is, please raise your hand, that thinks that this deficit can be solved by just budget cutting. And we're going to have to raise some revenue, or we're going to destroy this state, and that's my comment.
Mr. Would
you
like
to raise your hand and disagree with me?
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Carlson has a question as well.
Your co-chair.
Yeah. Right, there you go.
But I did have a...
Out of order.
I did have a follow-up to some of the questions dealing with higher education. It's this, with the magnitude of the cut. Historically, demand for higher education services has increased in a variety of ways. Additional sections needing to be opened on some of the campuses. I remember years ago we did a site visit up actually in Representative Rukavina's area when the iron mines were having great difficulty. We went into some of those community college campuses and they were teaching classes in the lunchroom. They were teaching classes in the hallways. I would argue that they were doing the right thing. They were going back and getting that education and preparing themselves for job changes and so on. The other day I had a conversation with the president of Normandale College, and he has started a special program for the unemployed, and they've got over 400 that have enrolled. That's just another example of how the demand increases, and at a time when they're going to have diminishing resources, I'm not sure that it's the wisest direction to go. And you need not respond. I'm just making that as a comment. I would hope that as this budget process proceeds, that you would think about some of those things and perhaps engage the chancellors and especially some of those college campus presidents that are really trying to manage these resources and probably are going to have great difficulty addressing that increased demand. You can only take so many students on what I call the margin, which is on the tuition side. And eventually, you're going to have some help with state appropriations as well as increased students arrive on those campuses. But enough said at this point, Mr. Chairman. But I hope that would be given some thought as you move forward.
Okay, Commissioner, you want to continue on? And our goal is probably about another half hour. So if you can continue on and hit the highlights.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members, this slide gives you an idea of the bite we take out of the gap in 12 and 13.
Commissioner, just on that point, roughly, the projected gap then, are you saying if we adopted the budget, the governor's budget with all the borrowing and the shift, that in 12 and 13 we would still have a $2.5 plus billion deficit?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and it doesn't, as we seem to always forget in times like this, but it doesn't factor in the inflation that we've had the debate on over the years.
And I understand the inflation is about a little bit less than about $700 million
now? Yeah, it's gone down with the inflation rate.
So if I add that in, we'd be about 3.2 roughly in budget deficit in the next year?
And 12 and 13 is correct.
And we plan to get out of that one next year we got all the shifts up, so I just want to point that out, that that's a real great concern, that we haven't really established a budget that is a sustainable paper budget. So, and our only hope to do that is to have a huge increase in income and jobs. So, and I know that number is going to be wrong. That's the only thing I know about it. But I think it puts us on a cautious plain, to be careful that we aren't just solving this budget short-term and not looking at the long-term implications.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You sound like me on the floor of the House last year saying, what are we going to do? We take all the easy money. I just wanted to offer some context to all this. This is going to be just one heck of a session. And I came to work. I'm in the minority. I will keep bringing my best ideas. And I think that this budget leaves a lot of us raw. This part I can't bear. But it's the governor's proposal, and he has a right to make a proposal. I didn't make up my own budget. There's no abler plan, and maybe I will have one on little parts of it. But there's some clever ideas in here, which you might find pretty appealing. Some another billion-dollar deficit coming our way at the end of February. And there's just not a lot of like in a deficit time. Not at all. And I think what the people sent us to do, I think why they gave the margins to most of you at the table, they did, because they needed to come and work together on this stuff. And I hope we don't spend the next month running around saying how bad some individual was for thinking of this, and what commissioner, what were they thinking of, and how could the governor do that? I'm really ecstatic that he held K-12 flat. I've been getting dozens of emails saying, please don't hurt our schools. You know, I hope the budget that comes out of the House and the Senate holds K-12 flat. I know some members, especially in other body, who were comfortable not keeping it flat. So in this budget, there's success. We're keeping my school open and keeping our teachers employed so they can have some budget to bargain on, so they can try to keep most of our schools open. We're closing schools probably next year, even at flat. I can't imagine cutting. The human service programs, I hold those dearly too. Spent all my time on that with Mr. Huntley and the members there. I live in a world where those people, I see them day to day. And they're having a hard time. But they're counting on us to do our best. And, you know, with my budget to cut higher ed, I don't know, I didn't have to make a whole budget that balanced out. But I hope that that we can keep our nose working on the matter at hand. And when you bring your budget out, mid-March or whenever they come out, I hope you hear me saying, we can work with this. Let's find a way to make it the best it can be. And I just hope that we can remember our respect for each other and respect for the 5 million people we serve in this state that are counting on us in the worst times in my lifetime. And that I ever remember, anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Aver, good. Commissioner, would you continue on, please?
Yes,
Let's,
Chairman,
let's go to the health care program.
I'm going to breeze through the health care because you said you wanted to finish in 25 minutes, and I'm assuming you want to have more of our discussion on the tobacco appropriation bonds and the federal stimulus. Is that?
Well, I think I would like to have the tobacco appropriation bonds or the appropriation bonds be discussed in Representative Housen's commission on Tuesday, I think, or committee on Tuesday. We have, I think, a good understanding of the big picture on that. If we can go to the health care programs on page 12 that you have here, the double one, and try to get the big picture of what's happening in that area, if you can.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the first bullet point, the governor made it a priority to preserve coverage for children. No child loses coverage in the governor's budget. Another important value for the governor is the reform aspects. We obtained better value through tying chemical dependency spending to performance. We established a statewide payment method linked to quality. The second point, we secure a better placement process for vulnerable children through North Star Care for Children program. And what this is, it combines three programs into one, simplifying assessment and payment process for counties, and aligns financial incentives and with outcomes for kids. And then we have, in response to the legislative auditor's report on the personal care attendance program, have reforms in that area as well.
Representative Granny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, wondering, thinking of performance in the K-12 field, what does it mean to tie it to performance in chemical dependency?
Mr. Walter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grayling, I'm not a great expert at this, but in essence, what we're trying to do is the chemical dependency program is a bit tied to rates. You see somebody, you get a certain rate. Some programs have more recidivism, others have more successes. What DHS is proposing is trying to look at the outcomes, which programs are working, pay them differential rates in order to help encourage people to be going to those programs so that hopefully if we're paying for CD treatment, the individual going through that program more likely will be able to deal with the problem.
Representative Redding.
I actually do support having success, especially the employment programs. I like to make sure people aren't just counseling, but people don't get jobs. But I also know, I always worry about the selection pool. You know, if you know you're going to be evaluated on who's going to be successful, then sometimes the chronic people that just don't get better might have a harder time finding somewhere to be served. And is there going to be any coefficient in the equation that would factor in the population?
Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure if we could follow up on that. I do know that one of the things DHS was looking at was not just the formula itself, but who makes those decisions. Currently, it's a county-based process, the same and separate requirements, and there's not all the right incentives necessarily in place to be looking for the best provider. And so they're also looking at ways to sort of pull back and make sure that it's not a county-by-county basis, that you can look across counties for the best provider. But we can get you more details on the formula.
Okay, would you continue on then?
Mr. Chairman, we reduce provider payments to hospitals, we eliminate the add-on, and assign a 3% ratable reduction to hospitals. Long-term care providers, a 3% ratable reduction, except nursing homes, and the only hit on nursing homes is repeal the rebasing that we put in the statute, I think it was last session. We consolidate programs and simplify eligibility requirements.
Well, isn't there, let me just correct it, in looking at the documents, Commissioner, I thought in the nursing home that there was also a change on the eligibility to enter a long-term care facility.
Mr. Chair, yes, there is.
May be significant for many nursing homes and families.
I believe that was more towards the waiver program, that what we're looking at in the recommendation is to ensure that an individual has the two ADLs, assisted daily living needs. The example is to transfer, to get days to close, other things that an individual needs simply to do their basic functions. At this point, that standard isn't in place. Given the demographic expansion in elderly, given the tightness of the programs in other states and comparable, the DHS recommendation was to make sure that there's a standard that's pretty clear for some of those waiver programs.
Okay, well, I think there's going to be a lot of committee hearings on that particular proposal. Continue on.
Mr. Chairman, the next point, we consolidate the Healthcare Access Fund and with the general fund and eliminate the dichotomy between expanding programs in the healthcare access fund when we cannot afford the programs we already have in the general fund. It puts them all on equal footing and allows us to make those decisions. We reduce eligibility for parents and medical assistants to 100% of the federal poverty level. No parents would not be eligible for Minnesota Care. Parents would migrate the 275 level down to 100% level. So those that were in Minnesota Care would lose coverage from 100% and lower. The parents would get coverage in MA. And
go ahead, continue.
If one more quick point,
yes.
Before there's a question, we maintain the general assistance medical care program at 75% of poverty for adults without children.
Representative Sales?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hansen, as I understand it, in 1991, a commitment was made when the Health Care Access Fund was created that the providers who pay this into this fund, the patients who pay a part of their fees that go into this fund, that would be maintained for people needing Minnesota care. It's a safety net for those people who do not have insurance. And I'm very concerned about breaking a pledge
to the, particularly the medical providers who agreed to this program all those years ago and have acted in good faith believing that this would be used for those who need medical help. And so is there going to be a safety net for these people? And can you explain what's going to happen now with these people who rely on Minnesota KISS?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swales, if there was any area of our budget that's probably going to perhaps get worked over the most due to the federal stimulus, it's this area. And they may be providing us with some maintenance of effort, which will require us to relook at some of these, some of the decisions we have made. And I would suspect we'll take a good hard look at all of these decisions in our supplemental budget.
Representative Clark, are you finished? Representative Clark?
Mr. I was just wondering if you could clarify for everyone what 75% of the federal poverty level means for a family of one, two, or three people, and the same thing for 100% of federal poverty level. I think those numbers need to have more of a face on them. Can you tell us what that means? What does a family have to be reduced to before they're able to get general assistance, medical care, or medical assistance?
Mr. Chair, we certainly can get those. I don't have the poverty guidelines here, and we can get that very shortly.
Okay. But I think to Mr. Chairman, to Representative Clark's point, we use terms like 100% of poverty, 275%. They're real dollar amounts, and they affect people, and they're fairly low. But we'll get them.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah, I just think it's important that we know what it really
Pardon me?
Yes, I would appreciate it. I think it's important that people know what how low those numbers are.
We will.
Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair, just a couple of things to point out to the committee. They are eliminating GAMC hospital only, which is a payment to if somebody shows up at the emergency room, they don't have any income, they're seriously ill, they need all kinds of surgery. The hospital-only program, they're retroactively enrolled in the hospital-only program, and the hospital then gets a payment from the state for those individuals. That is primarily a way to protect hospitals from the uncompensated care that they would deliver, and they're required by law, federal law and state law, to perform these surgeries on these people. They have to do it. If you look at what's happened to hospitals across the state in the third quarter of this year, their uncompensated care has skyrocketed. And as the economy gets worse, it's only going to get worse in these hospitals. So they're all going into debt. And the only thing they can do then is raise their rates to everybody else. So if the state doesn't pay for it, then the hospitals, rather than go broke, will raise their rates. And so you and I and every citizen of this state will pay for that uncompensated care with the premiums that you pay. And currently, in Minnesota, about $1,000 of your $12,000 family premium goes to cover uncompensated care today. So that's only going to get worse. So what we're doing is we're transferring a state obligation to individuals that have health insurance and are going to pay for it. That's my one point. The other point is that our analysis is that about 113,000 people will lose health insurance under this plan. And there's an Institute of Medicine study that shows that uninsurance leads to death nationally. It's about 16 to 20,000 people die every year because they don't have insurance. So I would ask Mr. Hansen to ask Commissioner Ludeman of the Department of Human Services to ask Mr. Hoffman, who does the projections for the Department of Human Services. First of all, if we take health insurance away from 113,000 people, how many of those people are going to die because of that? And secondly, would you ask him to figure out what the cost shift is going to be when the hospitals have more uncompensated care, and how much is the general health care premium of somebody else going to go up because of the cuts the state's making?
Would you provide that information to Representative Huntley, to the people that he asked you to obtain that from, and
you want us to
share that with the rest of us, too?
Mr. Chair, do you want us to provide information directly to a member to ask that through you and the...
Why don't you do that probably through myself.
So everybody gets it?
So everybody will get it, okay.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could, we were fortunate enough to have Representative Abler wander over to his office and pull out the 2009 Federal Poverty Guidelines.
Do you want to just read them?
Well, it's a chart from 100% that I can hand.
Just go down one.
The 100% of poverty for one person would be $10,830. So by my back-of-the-envelope math, I suppose 75% would be around $8,000 a year. For a family size of two, it's $14,500. Family size of three, $18,300. A family size of four, $22,000. Family size of five, $25,700.
Is that the 100%?
I'm doing down the 100%.
Okay, and your guideline is, your proposal is 75%.
Right.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Representative Dean, and then Representative Lester. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Hansen. You're talking about the General Assistance Medical Care Program going to 75%. Could you talk, does that reduce us about, if we go from 75% back down, is that half the people in GAMC, or what is the percentage of drop in headcount?
Can't even find you, Representative Dean. Oh, there you are.
Commissioner?
Say that, just the last part of that again.
How many people are currently in General Assistance Medical Care? I think it's 28,000, something like that. How many are going to be in GAMC after this?
Welcome to the committee, if you can identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Christine Vidal. I'm a team leader at Minnesota Management and Budget. The reduction of the GHO program is from 175 of federal poverty guidelines down to 75. I'm not sure exactly how many individuals are assisted by that benefit right now, but the majority of folks we have on GAMC would continue to be eligible at 75%.
Would you be so kind as to provide us with that information, please?
Yes, I would.
And we'll get that out in a timely fashion. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, thank you to the commissioner or whoever wants to answer it. I assume this is coming through. There, that's better. Can you also, maybe you can tell us now or provide us with the information, where does this put us in line in the nation and our neighboring states? Are we going to be substantially lower than what they're doing now? I'd just like to know how much lower we're going to be than what they are, and potentially they're making changes as well. But if you have any of that information, it would be insightful so we know that we're lower than North Dakota or Wisconsin.
Mr. Stolwalter?
Or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have some information from the Department of Human Services regarding the neighboring states, and certainly we can make that available to the committee.
Would you do that too?
Coverage for single adults is not common nationwide, but certainly coverage for parents, children, are always this program that you're going to find in other states, single adults less so.
And Mr. Chairman, I might want to clarify that when you say make it available, let's be sure you make it available to both the Ways and Means and Finance Committee members.
Yep.
For both you, right?
Mr. Dean, Representative Dean, did you have another question?
Well, I was just going to follow up. We currently use Minnesota Care. The Health Care Access Fund is used and was set up for Minnesota Care. We currently use that for 15 different sources outside of Minnesota Care. So we currently don't use that specifically for Minnesota Care. A lot of people think that we should. A lot of people think we should never have deviated from that, but we in fact do. It currently has a balance. And to Representative Huntley's point, I think we do need to preserve our private pays, particularly those of the folks who are right now putting off surgeries. So they are putting off care that they could be getting that they're not getting. So the reimbursement to hospitals is going down. And also, I think it would be wise to point out that as we put more folks on Minnesota Care, which is a program that reimburses hospitals less than cost, if we bring them from the private market to Minnesota Care, we are hurting small hospitals. If we are bringing people from GAMC to MA, we are helping hospitals. GAMC is a program that does not currently work very well with reimbursement for these folks. I think it's something that we need to look at, something that we need to look at going forward. But certainly these we are going to have an opportunity to move forward, and would certainly like to work with Representative Huntley and others as we propose this budget. I also had one question for Mr. Marks, if he could. If I look back, the last big budget deficit of $1 billion or more was in 2003. Previous to that, in my research, it was 1991. Is that correct, Mr. Marks?
Mr. Marks, can you answer the question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, 1991, 1992, yes.
And I'd,
Mr. Dean,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Marks, as I understand, I think that was the last time that that this legislature dealt with a deficit with one party in control of both houses. And there's very few of us, myself, just a relative newcomer around here, certainly was not around for even the 2003. So there's very few of us who have the experience of dealing with a massive budget. Dealing with a single party controlling both houses. And I think it's probably good that those that were there at that time remember and help the rest of us along with the bipartisanship that we're going to need to move forward with these very, very difficult cuts.
Sitting alongside of me is a representative who's been through 91 and 82 and a few others as well. And the same type of makeup was in place at that particular time within the governor and the legislature, and all three bodies moved, including the governor's position, moved in those particular negotiations. So in order for it to be bipartisan, everything is on the table and everyone is going to be moving. Commissioner?
The Chair, just for the record, we do have one of the pieces of information you were looking for previously.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I happened to find George Hoffman's forecast document. So the GHO average...
Would you identify what GHO is for
Both
of us?
It's General Assistance Medical Care Hospital Only.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. And the monthly average eligible for that program is around 160.
About 160 people?
Yes, correct.
Per month?
Correct.
And the question is, what will be the new standard? Is that correct? You will have that for us as well?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Okay, can we continue on?
Yes.
Ms. Showalter, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, if I may, the next slide is provide some information that you had requested yesterday. Just giving some of the line items, and these aren't even budget initiatives per se. These are some of the major areas of eligibility reductions and fiscal impact of them. We've been discussing several of these in the prior discussion. If you'd like, we can go on to the next slide or continue to discuss these.
So just one thing that we've talked a little bit about, in that long-term care rate reduction of $85 million, that's nursing homes and other programs that handle mostly services for disability and senior citizens. Would that be an accurate description?
Mr. Chair, that number includes a 3% rateable reduction for long-term care providers, except for nursing facilities. So it's the long-term.
But the rebasing is also included in that, is that well?
It's not included in that 85, but it is included in the package, Mr. Chair.
And so, from the forecast, what does that cost?
What's that reduction?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's $15 million for 10 and 11.
Okay, thank you. Representative Knuth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Showalter. I'm looking at this line item of adults without kids, and forgive me because I think I represent a demographic in this body that is not as well represented, with the thinking ages 19 to 34 being our highest uninsured by age. Just looking at those cuts to higher education, you know, we're expecting our young people to pay more for school. They're less likely to have insurance, and they have very significant cuts. I mean, adults without kids can be older or younger, but I'm curious what the makeup of that is with our 20 and early 30-something.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we'd also have to get back to you on the demographics of that.
Thank you. Okay, can we continue on?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The next slide is just identify some of the county services reform that are largely related to the Department of Human Services recommendations. There is an incentive for counties to consolidate and share services so that each county isn't individually delivering set of human services programs in each individual county. The objective is to try to find some ways that there's economies to scale and hopefully provide better service for service recipients, as well as make administration of these programs more effective. The net effect is zero for purposes of this budget. What essentially we have put in, and we'll find in language, is that the local aids or the county aids cut is essentially doubled. If a county chooses not to participate, chooses not to cooperate with other neighboring counties to find ways to collaboratively deliver services. If they do, then they basically get back to the number of the reductions that we were talking about earlier for County A.
So if a county doesn't do it, is there additional local County A cuts?
Yes.
And do we have a projection on what that might be?
Mr. Chair, a projection of what, how many counties may not participate?
Yeah, and I mean, you kind of do that with education already. You said that not everyone's going to be in QCOM, so you got a cost associated with it. What is your projections on that particular reform if a county is not able to for some reason? What is their additional reduction?
Mr. Chair, it's a good question. We struggled with that because it was a question of whether we would end up booking savings that, frankly, neither the counties nor the state probably would want to have occur, or whether there were enough enough time to allow counties to enter the program. At this point, our estimate is that counties will have enough time and enough incentive to participate.
Okay. Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner, is that correct? My question is, are you aware of the historical record on consolidation of human services delivery? Because I heard from my county administrator that they did deliver human services on a regional basis in the 80s, and it wasn't found to be very cost effective, and they abandoned that program. So I'd like to see the data on the historical record of past consolidation and whether it is effective.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that perspective or that information, but it would be a useful perspective. There are a couple of counties that are currently working through a joint powers agreement, and that seems to be effective. And I think it's more anecdotal that some small counties just really have a high variability, high cost of maintaining some of the complex programs that we're designing at the state level. They don't have the volume or the expertise to make it work.
That is Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner. I'm assuming that with this that I've got an example that was pointed out to by my city, but I'm assuming with this that the governor's departments are going to work with the cities and the counties to try and get this stuff together, because my city worked with a neighboring city to try and share services, and they just recently got a letter from the Department of Health that they got to stop, cease and desist, and stop doing it. And it saved both cities money, and it would be, my mayor pointed out to me that it was kind of ironic that just when the governor is giving his State of the State message, and talking about doing this, they're getting a letter from the Department of Health saying to stop doing what they're doing, which was saving money for both cities.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not familiar with that. That does seem going against the direction where the governor is trying to go. Just for the record, that this proposal really does only affect counties. It is not a consolidation of city services. Human services are delivered to the counties.
Okay, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I can understand everyone to consolidate some services. What are you thinking about driving times and distances for the public who uses those services? Do you have maximum? Is it 200 miles? Or what's your thinking here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not aware of a maximum distance. The idea is to really allow the counties to start thinking together about what are some of the travel patterns, what are the sort of the natural linkages between counties, so that some of that is really decided at a local level rather than the state creating Human Services Administration districts.
Representative Wagenius.
But you have put up a magic number of 15 regional systems, and that does seem to indicate to me that you are thinking that there are 15 spots in the state, and you must have some way of judging what the driving times are for people. I mean, I can see some things being consolidated, but other things it's just kind of far from my imagination. When you would ask somebody who has no money to drive 200 miles to a county program.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Walter,
I can check further about some of the assumptions or some of the potential groupings of counties. I think that certainly as you look at the delivery system, just because you may have coordinated and consolidated work between counties in delivering health and human services, it may not necessarily mean that you're going to not have some offices in certain places to deliver some of the services directly, but that ultimately you've got more expertise, more coordination across the state, so you don't have the same hierarchy, don't have, and perhaps you have a little bit more depth of knowledge.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd just like to reiterate what Representative Wagenius mentioned, because I can see that could be a huge problem in some of these areas that there's a very dense population, so at least consider it, if you would, please.
Okay, continue.
Mr. Chair and members, the next slide is regarding technology. In the governor's budget, there are a number of initiatives designed and intended to help the state of Minnesota deliver services the public expects more securely, more effectively, and more timely, and hopefully transparent way. Some of the initiatives that you see here include continuing the e-licensing initiative that was started 2 years ago, strengthening and improving the state data centers. We recently had a consultant's report looking at the data centers within the state, and their concerns were alarming in terms of the security, the technical capability, and the sustainability of those data centers. Furthermore, looking at continuing and finishing the integrated tax system, which was before the legislature 2 years ago. That is a system out of the Department of Revenue, intended to take a number of legacy systems, each which are running on different software, different platforms, with different databases, yet they serve all the state of Minnesota. Trying to find using a vendor who is able to take that information, put it into a single system with multiple modules, but a single system so that information can be shared and managed more effectively. And finally, to replace the accounting and procurement system of the state. It's a system that really touches literally every citizen of the state. It handles all of the transactions. It helps us procure all of our goods and services, and is also the real source on which we get our budget information. We get that information into our budget system. It is the source of all of the expenditure system that we all rely on.
And on this one here, members, in your packet, there are some significant expenditures here. So
just want to point that out where it says improved faith services. You may want to take a look at that one. I don't know if you want to comment, either of you, about the expenditure section on the handout, but it was in the packets.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that information is in the packets, and these systems are certainly expensive. We are well aware of that, and we'll try to manage that down as best we possibly can. Unfortunately, the cost of delay is also expensive. As you've seen, discussions, for instance, about the MAPS, our accounting and procurement system, over the last few years. Every year or two, a delay, we find from our consultants that prices in the going marketplace for those types of services tend to go up in significant amounts. The risk for the data centers and things like that could also be very expensive if something goes wrong. So you're absolutely right, it's expensive, and it was a careful consideration in a budget like this.
Okay. Do you want to move on?
Mr. Chairman, minimal fees increases in the general fund, it's about in the $2 million range. And if I remember correctly, the other funds is about $30 million.
Representative Grayling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hanson, what fees increase? Could you just give us an example so we have a flavor?
There is a fee on, just for some examples, the e-licensing slide that you, or the slide you just saw for technology, Representative Grayling, Mr. Chair. Has a we're expanding out our e-licensing for professional licenses, and we build the cost into the license over a period of years. There are other I think Jim has several. We have the food, beverage, and lodging fee adjustment for over $1 million. There's a food manager certification fee for $61,000. There's a fee for the regulation of lead work for $50,000 and $75,000 in 2011. There's a duplicate HOP license fee for $1,000, and they're all in that category. I can provide you. In many cases, the people or the professional licensees that they work with, they've already agreed to this fee, and it means an increase in service.
Commissioner, as a follow-up to Representative Grayling's question, you said $2 million in fees, and then you said $30 million in other.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
If you could just give us a general feel for what other.
Mr. Chair, the other is essentially what the Commissioner was detailing.
Yeah, right.
A number of the fees that are going for the health profession, so specific services that are on a fee basis where we recover costs to, and those are mostly in special revenue fund, state government special revenue fund.
Okay, I may be misunderstood. I thought you were talking about, in answering her question, the $2 million, but you're talking about...
There's one fee in human services. It's restructuring of licensing funding that is in the general fund for $720,000 in 2010 and $1.4 million in 2011. Otherwise, all the rest are in other funds.
Okay, so the total is really $32 million in various fees, then, is what you're saying. And most of them you're describing are...
Yeah, everyone
relatively small, except for the one that you just
said. That one, there's
a little larger.
Yeah, they're all, there's a health department maintain vital records surcharge of $1.1 million in 10 and $1.1 million in 11. And I think that's the, and then there's a pesticide fees increased in agriculture for 2.27 in 10 and 2.27 in 11.
I think that gives us a flavor relative to Representative Riley's and my question. The next slide we've already pretty well talked about, I think, the
we'll
tobacco.
Jump ahead to stimulus.
The appropriation bonds. I think for this purpose, we've pretty well covered that unless somebody's got an additional question.
Only if you wanted, Mr. Chair, to ask a broad question, it occurred to me that the one question this committee would
would want to ask is, you're looking at the whole budget, all the groups will be looking at the details, but the question I think we would ask is it a legitimate tool that can be reasonably expected to result in a balanced budget? That's the question both of you have. And so my question to the testifiers is, was this presented to bond council?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, yes, it was.
And do we have a letter with that, from them with background that that we could get at some point? I mean, I don't think you need to give us the details. I just thought that would be helpful if it was presented
if
to them.
If we just had the letter.
To
yes.
Representative Hausman, Mr. Chairman, that's not a problem. But yes, it has been discussed quite extensively with bond council.
And then, Mr. Chair, the other I think is the confusion we're feeling within the department about what to call them. It certainly says on all of your paper, tobacco appropriation bonds. But what I think I was hearing from Ms. Cardell, and it gets to the second point, there's little state risk. That's the... And what I'm hearing is that if we called them tobacco bonds, they're not marketable and that they are higher cost. Now, I'm assuming bond houses are reading the papers and they're hearing discussions like this. So help me understand why we're having difficulty deciding what to call them.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, for the record, I want to point out that I vociferously resisted calling these tobacco appropriation bonds because for that very reason. But the key point from the rating agencies and from an investor's perspective will be how any authorizing legislation is written. It is perfectly acceptable to authorize a broad-based state appropriation bond that we would say that we would intend to repay from any available revenues, but to utilize a specific portion of our revenues, in this case, the tobacco settlement receipts, as the source of funding to make those payments.
And yet you do take the, Mr. Chair, you do take the extra step. This proposal adds the state's assurance that bond payments will be made regardless of what happens to tobacco revenues.
And the statement that if I had written it, it would not say it that way, Representative Hausman and Mr. Chairman. What an appropriation credit, which is what this is, does not carry the full faith and credit of the state. It is not a general obligation bond of the state. They are not considered long-term obligations from a legal perspective. They're payable in each fiscal period as a current expense. They are always subject to appropriation.
And then, Mr. Chair, just finally, and that gets at the question of, is for us, does it give us a comfort level that this is a tool that balances the budget? Because they might be hearing us talk about them as tobacco bonds, and that we have disagreement about the language. Let's say we assume this is a good tool, we pass the bill, we adjourn, and then we can't sell the bonds. What happens?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hausman, there are, as there are with any bonding solution, there are always risks. And I would say that a market access risk such as you are describing is certainly one of them. We cannot, as we all discovered last fall, we cannot control the bond markets or what they do, and so that is obviously a risk. Another risk is if our general obligation bond ratings are lowered, because a rating for an appropriation-backed credit is tied to our overall general obligation bond rating. If our GL ratings are reduced, an appropriation credit will be reduced. That will result in a higher cost of borrowing, potentially not able to generate as many funds as we are anticipating at this time. And finally, there's always a risk, of course, that tobacco settlement receipts do not materialize as they have since 1999 and as they are projected to into the future, although that risk, I believe, is pretty well mitigated by the fact that at least this proposal assumes less than 50% of the annual receipts would be utilized for debt service.
And I think, Mr. Chair, my reason for asking that is it, normally in a bond sale, if we sell the bonds, we just don't let the bonds for a project. In this case, we're balancing a budget on them. And so I think that it does, that word risk does carry a little bit of extra
and
risk.
And Representative Hausman, last night when Representative Solberg and I and Senator Cohen had our briefing, I asked that very question because the sale would be October 1st. And we would be at that point, and that would be roughly half the bonds, as I understand it, but we would be already 3 months into the first year of the biennium.
Correct.
So I think we all have to understand, as you point out, Representative Hausman, there are some risks.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have risks. So it's probably a better risk than the corporate, as Representative Bunn would agree, probably it's a better risk than the corporate tax. It goes down quite a bit. We have a lot of risk in our budgets lately, and we're going to lose 1.2, 1.3 in February. Everything we do has a level of risk, and this is probably a better risk than just many of the other things, particularly on the revenue side, you know, the income tax and the corporate tax.
And I think Commissioner was saying the same thing. There is a risk. And
there's always,
the question would be how we would address
that
risk because the budget would have been built
we would
around
never
that. Well, we can.
Well, the
we're have a follow-up hearing on
what
this
we expected if there was no risk.
Yeah. Representative Westrum is next, and Representative.
Mr. Chair, I guess to the Commissioner, whoever's best to answer this, getting back to the LGA reductions, what's been made with the transit levy, primarily of the metro area, the market value credit, has that been reduced similarly with LGA payments? And secondly, have you looked at reducing eligibility for other rebate programs we have in the state? I know I'm aware of some that go up to $80,000-$90,000 of income, and you're eligible for rebates under our programs. Lastly, anything in the Department of Corrections areas to further savings with incarcerating our prisoners? Looking at the Appleton model with private contracting, is there any reform that looking in that direction to mitigate costs in other areas for schools or nursing homes?
Maybe if you could be as quickly as you can. I thought it was going to be relative, the question, to what we were discussing on the bonds. So maybe if
you want me to
quickly address it. Representative Kahn, I think, had one relevant to bonds.
I can wait on that for a second. Then. I can wait. I think it'll take me a minute to answer.
There were several questions there. Again, it does take
probably take me 10 minutes.
If you can wait, then Representative Weston, you don't need to repeat the question. He'll get to it. But Representative Kahn, on the subject that was before.
I understand the state of Minnesota has never done these appropriation bonds before, but have other states done them? And done it other? In other places, and are we going to learn something about the history of how other states have used these?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, actually the state has done appropriation-backed bonds before, several times. No, those were a revenue bond. When we entered into lease obligations with the Port Authority when we built the Department of Human Services building and the Health and Ed building, those bonds are secured by an appropriation credit. When we sold bonds, we didn't sell bonds. The city of Bemidji sold bonds to build a Bureau of Criminal Apprehension facility back in 1998. Those bonds are a state appropriation credit. The bonds that the University of Minnesota issued to finance the TCF Bank Stadium are secured by state appropriation credit. They're not the credit of the University of Minnesota. So it is not, even though we don't necessarily talk about it that way, we've done this several times. And in fact, states, broadly, there are many states that don't have the ability to issue anything other than an appropriation-backed bond. One of my former clients in my prior life, I was the state of North Dakota, they're prohibited by their constitution for issuing general obligation bonds. All they can do is issue appropriation-backed debt. And with respect to bonds that other states may have done that were related to their tobacco settlement receipts, North Dakota, California, New York, and Oregon have all done financing that over several of them over several years, but starting back in 2003. So there is experience with that.
I'm reminded of the necessity to speak into the mic.
What's the interesting is every one of those that you listed was a construction base. I'm interested in this appropriation, which is not a construction base. All of those appropriation funds, and I am familiar with all of those, were all for a construction of some kind. So you had the state was backing a construction. This seems a little bit more ephemeral to me.
Ms. Cardell.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, I would say, and I'm sorry I don't have a gory detail of all of the individual financing here with me right tonight, but most of those states might have used a portion of it for that purpose, but most of them used it for some form of budget reprogramming or budgetary relief. There's almost none that utilized it purely for capital construction.
In the mic, please.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I'm also interested as we're dealing with constitutional issues that, you know, we have continually talked about how we're constitutionally required to have a balanced budget. What happens if we don't?
Ms. Cardell.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, I'm not an attorney. I'm not sure.
Maybe it's today, Mr. Hanson. What happens if we violate? I think we're looking at several points where we may be violating parts of the Constitution, but what happens if we don't, if we don't have a balanced budget?
Commissioner?
We are required to have a balanced budget by the end of the biennium. I think in the case of, in this case, we have gotten advice from our bond counsel, and we are very comfortable with the advice we've received. I don't know what legal action would happen, or Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn.
Okay. Usually, Mr. Chairman, we don't do things that we're required to do. There are some consequences. I want to know, I'm just asking what the consequences are if we don't meet this constitutional requirement.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I would presume we would find out before the end of the biennium, and like everything else in our budget, from the collections we receive to the, Mr. Chairman and I were talking about, there are our forecast changes all the time. So there is, in every dollar we have in our forecast, some level of risk when you predict out 2.5 years. We are fairly confident in our ability to sell these bonds, or we wouldn't have it in our budget. And if I could add, Mr. Chairman, when you see the legislation that comes before you, as well as the tracking sheets you have, they are referred to as appropriation bonds. Our descriptor is not a was our attempt to be transparent and try to give you the where we got the idea and how it and how it follows from start to finish. So it was more of our effort to be descriptive than anything else. But they'll legally be appropriation bonds.
Okay, we'll take a couple more questions on this section and then revert back to the question that Representative Westrom had. Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hanson, I've heard you say that you've consulted a lot with bond counsel, and I also heard you say that there's risk in this budget. So my question is, with the risks and the shifts that are maxed out here, do you think that that's going to have an impact on our bond rating, and do you think we're at risk of lowering our bond rating?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I think there is in every budget. You know, I started my presentation saying we had a $34.1 billion budget, and the risk over the course of the biennium none of us saw. So it's not the risk that's in the economy right now is something we all could not have foreseen when we put our budget together.
there's risk in the human services numbers because we don't know, as good as George Hoffman is at the Department of Human Services, we don't know how many people are going to come through the door in the next 2.5 years. We know in a bad economy that there's probably more. We know that in a bad economy, people don't work and they pay less income tax. We try to estimate. Every budget has a level of risk, and that's why every forecast is off. So I don't want my words taken out of context. It's all when we're dealing with this amount of dollars and the, you know, 4.5 million people in our state and millions of transactions, you're judging the behavior of a lot of things happening. So putting a budget of this, the $57 billion, there's going to be some risk at what the numbers are. We hope that it's going to be more. It isn't always. As far as the bonding we've done or any of the proposals, we feel that they are the best for our state in a deteriorating economy, and we are not. We think adding another tax increase would stifle the growth that we're already seeing, and it would be contrary to what they're doing in Washington and the federal administration. We think any additional cuts would be harmful to our state, and that's why we settled on the number that we did.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up to that, Mr. Hansen, my question was, what if you talk to the bond council, has the bond council weighed in on whether or not they think there's too much risk here that it might put our bond rating in jeopardy?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hellstrom, that would not be the bond council's role to assess. I think you're talking about a credit rating. Are you talking about credit rating risk?
The AAA bond
rating. Right, the rating risk. That would not be their role.
I'm Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Their role is to assess the legality of the appropriation back structure.
So who would be the person to assess that then?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hellstrom, the actions that we take, whether we utilize this tool, whether we make deep cuts, all of these things will be factors that the rating agencies will look at upon the conclusion of this session and how we resolve this situation. I think it is very difficult to point to one particular action as being the item that pushed it over the edge.
Mm-hmm. Representative Cole.
Okay.
I think we're done with this section, and we'll take up the question. I think, Commissioner, you remember what the question was.
I do. I wrote them down.
Okay. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, I think your first question involved the state takeover of the transit, the opt-out and the transit tax from about 2001. Is that correct?
Correct.
We don't have any proposal affecting that in this budget.
We should, I'm not aware of one. We can follow up, but I'm not aware of one.
And then on the second, the eligibility rebate, I wasn't quite sure which rebate programs you were talking about.
Mr. Chair, if they're not aware of them, they're not in there. I haven't found them yet either. I'd be happy to share with you ideas for the future. But I'm just saying there's other areas we should be looking at. I don't think this budget's even gone into some of the easiest areas we could change. And so I think this is a start. It's a proposal. There's some areas that I think our budget still needs revision, reform, reducing, and we don't have to affect grandma in the nursing home or school classrooms. We certainly could add them in. So I'm aware of eligibilities as high as that income range, and we need to be looking at them.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, I would love to follow up with you to talk about that.
Yeah, I think the next slide then is the several opinions.
Mr. Chair, the corrections area was the last part of my question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, it's a conversation you and I have had before involving corrections. It has been our administration's position that building and maintaining state-owned prisons over the long term is in our best interest, and we're better able to manage our costs. I think the states that have over a heavy reliance on private prisons, after a while, as they close their public prisons, they become, they have very few choices but to pay the rate that the private prisons have. So we do have a mixture in our state, but we have in our bonding bills in the past been adding to our prison in Faribault and have pursued that that course.
The next slide, then.
Mr. Chair, members, the last slide, or second to last slide, is the federal stimulus package. As the Commissioner mentioned at the outset of this presentation, there's a couple of big unknowns in this budget proposal. On the downside is the economy, knowing that the federal, the GDP, the gross domestic product numbers that we're seeing from our national forecasters are substantially worse than we even used in the November forecast. On the other hand, the big upside risk is some level of federal stimulus, that which will come through both in direct aid, spending offsets, and earmarked sort of dedicated funds for construction projects or other purposes. The governor's budget includes $920 million in as an assumption of direct state aid that would be applicable to the general fund budget deficit. You all have seen different information from NCSL, from other sources. There are all kinds of numbers out there. The House bill currently, most estimates, I've seen about $3.2 to $3.3 billion in money for Minnesota. Not all of that would be applicable to the general fund problem that we've been discussing here. A good share of that would be for other purposes, would go to other units of government, would go for specific purposes that would not be really used for this. However, there is public stuff, and the governor includes $920 million based upon really rough calculations, really rough estimates at this point on getting some level of increased matching funds for Medicaid. As the members of the Human Services Committee well know, we pay only 50% on the dollar for our health care program. What the federal government is likely to do is offer us a little bit more than a 50% match for a period of time, probably over a course of three fiscal years. So instead of getting 50 cents on a dollar, we might get 54.9 on a dollar, something like that, which will decrease state spending, which will yield savings to the general fund. The other part is the stimulus, a stabilization funding. That will likely have a couple of different areas, some for education, some for higher education, some for general government. A lot of these things are still being worked out, and we're learning more literally every day. The governor's budget includes $920 million assumption. We're hoping that one way or another we're going to get a more definitive number, more definitive information on maintenance of effort requirements, which will have a direct impact on what the governor's proposal will be before the next forecast and before he would then resubmit updated recommendations. But that is, of course, another risk, and hopefully it will one that will play out so that, unlike some other states, we've actually got it in the process so that we will have a March forecast that we can incorporate it into our numbers and the governor can incorporate it into his budget recommendations.
This is a matter of information for the committees that are here. As most of us probably knew, it was before the U.S. House today, and it did pass 244 votes to 188. I think that's the first time I've ever announced a congressional vote in committee, but at times members have announced some athletic scores periodically.
I thought it was a Gopher score.
But that's step one, and of course we all know then the Senate has a different version. I think the way you described it yesterday or last evening was that it was a placeholder at this point in time. Yes. So, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. You basically touched on some of my questions. The 800-pound gorilla in the room is what happens in February with the budget forecast and all the numbers we're hearing that it's going to be upward of 6 or above 6, the 7 million, or billion, excuse me, put the right zero decimal point in the right place. And if the stimulus package comes through, are we going to have the money to be able to match it? Are we going to have to possibly look at not taking some of this as maintenance effort that's going to have tails that we're going to have to maintain this if we get it? I mean, do we have the stuff built in here in this so that when in February when we have to
use that number to actually build this budget off of, that we can do this and follow through with what the governor's programs here are.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the money is there, but we may have to look at recasting or changing some of the governor's proposals depending on what some of those maintenance of effort requirements are going to be. Example, for the stabilization funding, there's going to be some level of effort based upon education spending as of probably 2006 or some other year. So depending on how that's defined or what that means, that may be a problem or it may not be. On the federal Medicaid matching funding, there's going to be probably some eligibility maintenance from, I believe it's 2008. So that, again, may be an issue with some of the changes in the governor's budget. It wouldn't be for some others. So those things are going to have to be worked out once we know literally what the law is going to say and literally what are the factors that they're going to have to deal with, because those can be fairly technical. But they have big impact.
Okay. Representative Foles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up a little bit on Representative Nelson's question, I heard Chair Solberg this morning on NPR talking about, you know, one of his concerns with the governor's proposal was that, from his perspective, it didn't do enough in the outbiennium. There wasn't enough structural balance. We weren't taking care of enough of that problem. So I guess my question is, do we know enough yet about the federal stimulus legislation to have any reasonable guess as to how it's going to affect the out years, the tails in, you know, that I know Representative Solberg's concerned about, I'm concerned about too. I share his concern.
Maybe you could share with us what that number is, just so everybody knows what the out biennium shortfall is.
The out biennium shortfall,
$2.5 billion.
Under the governor's recommendations, Mr. Chair, Representative, and the stimulus package is entirely one time. It is effective state fiscal year 2009-10 and expires in 2011. So there will be no additional federal funding for the last part of 2011. 12 and 13 would revert back to former levels of federal fiscal aid, and the state would be seeing none of that funding coming forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, to further answer your question, the extent to which the federal stimulus money in 10 and 11 is used to buy off or cut, referencing our budget, that are permanent out into 12 and 13, it could result in a worse tails number.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, thank you. That was the point that I mean, that was my supposition, and I guess I would caution us in light of Chair Solberg's concern about tails. I know many of us here are concerned about the long-term structural budget issues. Relying too heavily on the manna from Washington may get us into trouble over the long term, and so I think we just need to be. We need to be mindful of how we deal with that money and how much we rely on it going forward, because we may be solving a short-term problem, and you know, we'll all be back here 2 years from now scratching our heads again over how we're going to get out of the next mess we've pushed on to the next biennium.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I share Representative Paul's concern, too, about the one-time federal money, but even worse, you know, all the shifting in this budget. And I don't understand as much as Representative Houseman about what happens if we lose our bond rating and so forth. But, Mr. Chair, I would hope that we could have some discussion of that in this committee, because I just like to understand better the cost if we don't have a AAA bond rating, and you know how I just worry, because we have not been. I don't see how we're going to be able to pay back the shift in a timely manner like we did the last time we shifted. And then we couple that with this federal money. I share Representative Kahn's concern about you know, how constitutional is this budget when we are not we're not really balancing it. It's just a house of cards, and you know, schools are glad to have the credit card maxed out so that they don't have to be cut this year, but then what about next time? The governor talks about sitting around the kitchen table, and you know, but whenever I think about sitting around the kitchen table with Minnesota people. I think about, you know, coming out with a family budget that balances, not one where you max out the credit card, you borrow from Washington, D.C., and you don't, nobody else gets a job, you don't make real cuts that can hold. I don't think the Health and Human Services cuts are workable in a state like ours with an ethic that we have to care for people. So I just am very worried about a lot of things. And so I would hope we could discuss that bond rating at a minimum.
I suspect that issue will come up in Representative Hausman's committee, but after Representative Hausman's done, there probably be some opportunities maybe here, because you're not, I don't think you're on that division.
No, Mr. Chair.
So maybe we can figure out a way to get that discussion before the committee for information for other members as well after Representative Hausman's hearing. Any other questions at this point?
Mr. Chair, not a question, just a comment. Representative Greiling, House of Cards, I've heard that phrase around here before. I don't think it has as much honey in it as vinegar, but just remember, you'll have the opportunity to come up with the plan, and it'll have to be more than the blank sheet of paper that was proposed in 03 by some people in here. So this is a start. I think we'll be anxious to see others' proposals that have talked about them in here today.
We've got one more slide left.
Mr. Chair, members,
including comments, however you want
this
to.
This is the last slide. Just to wrap
well
up the numbers. Comparing 2008 and 9 versus governor's recommendations in 10 and 11, as you see, the spending numbers, the revenue numbers that we've discussed, maintaining a cash flow account, putting some money into the budget reserve. We know there's risk. We know that there's economic risk that's out there, and we're trying to make sure that the state continues the financial management practices that we've seen before.
Mr. Chairman, just one point. The 234 on the bottom line in 8 and 9 reflects our assumption that some of the federal stimulus is going to come in the current biennium.
And Representative Murphy.
Are we done with all the slides?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought you was your hand up.
I did have my hand up, but I wanted to make sure that they had made their concluding remarks.
I think they were done, so we're ready for your question, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to bring one thing to the attention of committee members, and this is my only opportunity to do it because I'm not on the committee that will deal with this, but I understand that your early priorities were top budget priorities, protect state public safety programs. And I think protecting the programs should also include protecting the people. And it's been brought to my attention that there is a recommended pension change for 3% of our state employees in the budget recommendation. And very early in the 1980s, I learned that it is not easy for the state legislature in any way to change conditions of a pension plan if the employees don't understand it. I go to a meeting of retired public employees two or three times a year, and there's a lady named Vivian that says, "Have you paid back my pension yet?" She never lets me forget that the legislature changed pension language midstream. And they never understood how it was paid back. The Democrats in here will remember the first retreat that we had talking about the budget bill when Governor Pawlenty came to talk to us in the morning in January and or December, whenever it was. Governor Carlson came to talk to us in the afternoon. And twice during former Governor Carlson's speech to us about what we should do to reach out to solve the budget problems and that it wasn't going to be easy. Twice in that speech he said, don't mess with people's pensions. And in this bill, in the public, in the Department of Public, Department of Corrections, and the secure, in the Department of Human Services for the secure treatment facilities, there's a recommendation to change the pensions now of people that were anticipating that they were in the correction plan. It's taking some of the people out of the correction plan and putting them back into a plan that will look like the plan did in 1974. Now, the law that allowed them to change and qualify for the correction plan, because they worked 75% of the time, at least 75% of the time. The law that did that was in 1995 or 96. Since that time, their rates of contributions have gone up and are continuing to go up now to bring them closer to the employer's contribution. As I read this, and I haven't talked with anybody about this yet, as I read this, there's going to be a 0.61% reduction to the Department of Corrections budget for this. And I can think of all kinds of ramifications. At the time this was put in, the nurses weren't running the health program in each of the facilities. There was a doctor there. But now it's just nurses. There were teachers that were working more than 75% of the time. Psychologists working more than 75% of the time, sometimes in groups and sometimes one-on-one type thing. And I just can't anticipate that a nurse will ever apply to work at the Department of Corrections if there's not some incentive. The morale at these facilities are going to be hard to explain why this goes through, and the morale is going to go down. They're not going to understand how this happened to them when they've been in the program for 13 years at least, and now they can't be, and they've already paid that additional money, and they have to go back. I just think, is it worth it? Is it worth the problem for 0.61? Is there some other way we could work so that we're not messing with these people's pensions? Now, I think part, as I read this, I think part of the savings is from the collective bargaining agreement, not, that doesn't have anything to do with the pension. If you're early out, you, I believe they bargain collectively for health insurance for the 10 years from 55 to 65. But you must know people that are planning on retiring in a year or two. And now that they're going to be told, after all that, that they have to go 10 years or 8 years more. And if the savings is because of the health insurance, we've got to find a different way. And I want to work with you on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I will always work with you on anything. What Representative Murphy is referring to is a provision in our budget in the corrections department regarding in the corrections plan. There is a provision in the plan that allows retirement at the age of 55 and full health coverage until the age, I think, of 65. What the governor's proposal is, recognizing the realities in the job market that there's, you know, thousands of people losing jobs. Not many can retire at the age of 55 and get all their health care covered. We made the decision to non-security guards at the prisons and non-security counselors at the state-operated services. Everyone other than those two categories would revert away from the corrections plan. They would not be able to retire at 55, and then the retirement age would be the same as the rest of the state plans, and then the health care would not be covered. It was a very agonizing decision, but something in light of the economic times and the challenges we're facing, we went ahead and made, and we'll continue to discuss and work with you on it.
Representative Murphy.
Just one question. Do you have legal advice on whether the collective bargaining part could be changed for the medical care?
Yes, we did. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy.
I just don't see how that's constitutional, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any further comments, Representative Murphy or anyone else before we're about ready to adjourn? I want to thank everybody then. Representative Solberg and I talked a little bit about how long the hearing would be. He thought an hour and a half, and I thought he was a little bit optimistic, let me put it that way. But we did do it in 2.5 hours for a very lengthy budget. So with that, thank you again, everybody, and meeting adjourned.